Welcome to Productivity Mastery. Stoy here, a productivity and performance coach on a mission to help businesses and people get the most out of their time. On this podcast, I'll bring you exceptional performers and together unlock what it takes to perform at your highest level. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy this episode. Some of you know, I started finance in Denmark, and Remy has been, and I'm not joking, I'm not trying to praise him here, but he was my favorite teacher. I had him as a teacher in one of, as a summer school, when I was taking some of my credits in as a summer school, and I did have a few different very interesting subjects that I was studying, but there is no competition. He was indeed my favorite teacher, teaching negotiations in a very experiential and very engaging way. So I'm super, super excited to have with me Dr. Remy Smolinski. Hope you're done with this. And Remy, why don't you introduce yourself and share with the audience who is Dr. Remy Smolinski, or should I say Professor Smolinski?
Right. Thank you so much, Jankon, Stoyan, for having me. It's a great pleasure and an honor to join. It's amazing to observe how skyrocketed your career has since the last time we've seen each other in Aarhus in Denmark. I'm a negotiation and innovation professor and advisor. I teach research in both areas which have a lot in common, something we can explore later on in our conversation. But I'm very passionate about exploring the depths of negotiation, exploring the depths of what makes people innovative and companies innovative. I love sharing it with others. Yeah? I teach primarily negotiation. We organize negotiation competitions as well to help people understand what it means to negotiate well, what it means to come up with wise agreements.
Thanks. One of the things that I'm really excited to explore is, you've had a very interesting career, in my opinion, because you've been a professor, researcher, teaching people how to be better negotiators, teaching innovation. At the same time, you've been very involved in the industry as well. How was it for you possible to balance out this type of career?
It's a great question, Stan, and this is something I've heard many, many times. Every time I meet my very good friend Petra, this is exactly what she says, right? And my answer has been always the same. Eh? If something is your passion, you'll always find time for it. Yeah? And I'm very unfortunate. I'm unfortunate because I discovered three things that have defined the course of my life, and that's one of them is the first one was negotiation, then innovation, and the third one was sports. I used to play a lot of volleyball, something that we kept in touch over the years. It's never the case that we don't have time. We use it very often as an excuse for important things, for things that. That touch our hearts, yeah? We will always find the time. And if we don't find time for something, it just means that it's not important to us. Yeah? And that has been my answer to Petra always. This is important to me. And even if it means for me, sleeping a little bit shorter or working on over the weekends, I do it gladly because that defines who I am. That defines the content of my life. And it's something that makes me happy.
Since we're on the topic of time, and you know, this is a very important topic in my work, in my career, how can we get the most out of our time? And we're going to get, with those of you who are watching and listening right now, we're going to get into negotiations, effective negotiation strategies. But I'm just super curious to hear, how does your time management look like with having strategic roles, advisory roles in companies, being a professor, at the same time, if I'm not confused, looking at your LinkedIn, I've seen you've been a CEO of a company for a year in China last year. You do a lot of different projects. So how do you prioritize your time so you can stay for? Because seeing you from the outside, I see somebody who's very calm, very chill. Seems like everything is just like, you know, going smoothly. So how do you do that? How do you achieve that?
I think the inner peace comes from the ability to reconcile conflict, the ability to reconcile those priorities comes from having a clear prioritization system. Yeah? I'm personally a very big fan of Eisenhower, right? There are things that are urgent and there are things that are important. And the combination of these two gives us four quadrants, which pretty much, if you want to simplify it to the bare bones, allow us to prioritize things that need to be done today over the things that maybe could be done tomorrow. Yeah? And prioritizing means also the not doing certain things. And I've been very fortunate to be able to surround myself with very capable individuals. Yeah, very capable individuals, ambitious individuals who associated me on sort of on my way, and who supported also me in my projects. And this is something which I believe, while prioritizing certain things and while having certain strategic allies for those things, we can achieve more. We can achieve more, and this only works under the condition that we are able to and willing to work with each other. Cooperation. Cooperation is one of the key skills, just like the ability to resolve conflict or to negotiate. The ability to cooperate increases our own productivity.
I love that. And when you mentioned the word skill, I just want you to know that probably asks you, but is negotiation a skill and why?
Oh, definitely it is. Any other definition would pretty much force us to kick it out of an educational program or a curriculum of every single educational institution. Yeah? It's only because there's a consensus among the negotiation scholars to define it as a skill. It only then makes sense to offer courses that aim to improve it among the participants, so be it the students or the executives or whoever else. Yeah, there are various components to this. One of them is yes, we all start from a certain level. That is something we call talent, yeah? If we will, the ability, the aptitude to perform a certain activity, and then we call something a skill if with systematic training and coaching we are able to improve it. Yeah? And negotiation, the consequences of defining negotiation as a skill are profound. Yeah? There is a consensus that negotiation is a skill. It is possible to improve the results of us, of the students, executives, regardless of the amount of experience and talent. But it requires systematic training and structured feedback, right? And this structured feedback and systematic training is something that I've been passionately providing to my students over the last, I don't know, 15 years or so, and also to the executive, my clients. That's the key and the consequence of the definition that I've mentioned. Yeah, it is a skill because it's possible to improve it, and that gives us a possibility also to spread our wings and offer those services to those who may potentially need them.
And I have to admit something here. Now, definitely after your course, it completely changed my horizon, it changed my life. The course because that was my first touch to understanding negotiation. I just heard the word before. I probably negotiated all my life in different areas of my life, but I didn't consciously pay attention to what negotiation means. And one of the assumptions I had was that everything happens at the table. You go to a table, you negotiate, and you leave. And I know it was probably 2012 when I was your student, but one thing I remember is that you mentioned, and please correct me if your view is different or if I remember it wrongly, but you mentioned back then 90% of the negotiation is preparation.
Yes.
Am I correct? Or
oh, yes. the number, I'm not sure about the the large percentage, the large contribution and attribution towards a negotiation success lies before actually we start exchanging information at the negotiating table. Yes, that is absolutely correct, and this is something that has not changed. Yeah, negotiation is not magic. Yeah, there is no magic spell. There is no magic drink that if you say it, if you drink it, you'll get everything that you want, right? It's a skill that consists of certain components, and one of them is a solid preparation. And that's absolutely correct. And solid preparation typically beats eloquence and rhetorics at the table.
Great. And we have our first question, which is connected to the question I wanted to ask. It is from Arhiat. I just checked it on LinkedIn. So he says, hi, Stoyan and Remy. Thank you for a great interview. May I ask, what is the basic strategy for negotiation?
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for this question. Strategies, negotiation strategies are context dependent. And what does it mean? There is no one universal or basic strategy that just beats everything else, regardless of who we negotiate with or what we negotiate on. Negotiation strategy is a function of exactly these two and more parameters. The key parameters to crafting negotiation strategy are exactly the ones that I've mentioned, and that is the relationship, that is the person at the table. Who is that we are to negotiate with? And second, what is that we negotiate on? And these parameters, when we put them all together, they evolve into a spectrum of potential strategies. So let me give you just a couple of quick examples to illustrate what I mean. Let's assume that we are about to sell a car or sell a house. Most likely, we will never deal with the same person again. Most likely, once we've sold the object and we received the money, that's when the deal ends. This is something, in these two examples, money is what matters. It's possible to expand the scope with additional dimensions, but if we restrict our view to the most simplistic situation, money is what matters. Relationship ends when we shake hands, basically. Yeah, simply in a simplified meaning. What does it mean? We are in something which is called a distributive negotiation. And in distributive negotiation, I will use something which is called value claiming strategies. I will do everything it takes to make sure that at the end, I as a seller get the highest possible price. And that's the simplification of the simplest negotiation strategy or the simplest family of negotiation strategies. If we change the parameters that we've discussed, relationship and substance, our negotiation strategy will have to become more complex. We'll have to become more sophisticated. So let me give you this quick description of a different context. Let's say we negotiate with someone that we have an existing relationship with, and second, we negotiate a complex deal that involves certain parameters. Applying the simplistic strategy of distributive negotiation or value claiming to that context would leave a lot of value on the table, would burn a lot of money. So in that case, we need to pursue completely different objectives. We need to create and claim value, and while creating and claiming value, while engineering value, we need to take care of the relationship, because there will be future. We will see each other again. And that is a much more negotiation context, which requires also a much more sophisticated negotiation strategy.
Okay, so these are the basics of understanding what could be the different situations. I'm curious, many people are starting, you know, maybe they're watching right now, and as a topic, as an area of you know, knowledge, so to say, negotiate something new. What are some of the key components or like elements to have in consideration? For example, something that was eye-opener for me when I was starting the course at your summer school was the BATNA, right? So I'm just curious if you can share some basic concepts for the people who are watching right now or listening to the podcast that they have to have in mind to be able to. And by the way, guys, this is not just for business. I mean, obviously, a lot of you are watching on LinkedIn, on Facebook, in terms of how can I use this for business. But I mean, this is something you use every single day, right? You need to go to a dinner with your wife. There are some certain things you might want to negotiate. It's a universal skill, and it can completely change your life in terms of getting more, as you said, claiming value, but at the same time creating a better relationship and leaving the other side better than before you met them. So that's the whole thing. It's about creating relationships by generating value in between each other. That's how I understand it, at least.
So absolutely. Absolutely correct, Stoyan. Thank you so much for this question. Thank you for this summary. This is exactly what it is. I recently, I don't remember for what, but wrote a thought piece on negotiation. One of the things that I've included at the end is that negotiation skills change the quality of life, because all of a sudden they allow us to look at potential conflict as an opportunity to create value. It's not easy. It's not easy to me also, as someone who has dealt with this topic for many years, because whenever there is conflict, there are emotions, and those emotions sometimes stand in a way of good value engineers. We simply fail to deal with substance because we are emotionally aroused. But apart from this aspect, being able to move over the differences and use them as an invitation to improve the situation for all involved parties is something that over time has greatly changed my life and life of my many of my students. Because all of a sudden, many of them perceive negotiation as bargaining, as a win-lose concept, right? So I have to be better. I will just kick your butt in the next negotiation. I'm the best. I'm the king of the jungle, and you're going down. And this is something. This is a common misconception, a common myth. There are cases where win-lose is unavoidable. And those are the distributive cases we've already discussed. But the vast majority of negotiation problems allow us to create value, are complex enough, include more than one dimension with different priorities over those dimensions that the parties possess. And if these two preconditions are met, it's an invitation to create value, although it doesn't look like it at the moment of that conflict, as this conflict happens. So coming back to your question, being more specific, BATNA is one of the central concepts that I think stays with everybody who has dealt with the concept of negotiation. Before thinking about solutions, we need to first of all figure out what happens if we don't find it. In other words, what is my best alternative to a negotiated agreement, the BATNA? Because if I fail to agree, this is what is going to happen. So the quality of my BATNA, the attractiveness of my BATNA defines also my negotiation power. Because I can go as high or as much or as low or as ambitiously as my BATNA allows me to. So ultimately, if I don't get it, if I don't get the deal I end up with. And this is what I'm going to end up with. So I have to focus on is to first of all establish the BATNA and use it as my reference point in the back of my mind. That's the key of for almost every negotiation. And the conflict situation. What happens if we don't resolve it? What changes for you? What changes for me? Can I deal with this? Is it attractive? Am I happy with this state or not? And this is something, this is very, this has been for many years already, almost 40 years, has been a central concept of negotiation science, negotiation science debate. There are lots of more, there are lots of more concepts out there. I think going through more would probably exhaust the time that we have for this podcast. But if someone is interested, hey, please reach out to me. I'm happy to discuss more.
That leads me to another question, which is, can you share maybe some example from a negotiation that you were part of that was not going well, but then using some of these concepts and ideas, you managed to reach an agreement that was mutually beneficial?
Lots of them. I don't know whether a particular example comes to my mind spontaneously, but in general, very often. Oh, I remember something very specific. My last job my last employer. One of the things we faced is we wanted to introduce an innovative product, and to be able to do so, we needed a partner. We needed a partner who provides us with a very particular service, which we couldn't, without a major investment, build ourselves. And I remember very well, this project was initially managed by someone on my team. And she has gone over those partners and came back to me and said, well, they disagree. They all rejected me. They don't want to deal with us. We don't find an agreement. And then we started getting into why. So what were the reasons? What were the arguments? Why didn't they want to engage in a cooperation? Why didn't they want to provide us with what we needed? And I did the second round myself. So I visited some of them where she thought the conversations were the most promising, but still ended in a rejection. In those meetings, I specifically asked why lots of times. So why is that you are uncomfortable with this? Or what is about it that bothers you? And so on and so on, so that I could understand the nature of the problem for them. As we build the relationship, maybe one of the things that made it easier is that one of those partners was a former colleague of mine that we worked together with, who was very open about answering my why questions. And at some point we got to the core of the problem, and the problem was that first of all, no such cooperation existed in the market. And players who were able to provide the service that we needed were very reluctant to, or were very keen on keeping the users for themselves. And so were we. So ultimately, the question that we needed to solve is the user ownership. Who owns user, the user data, who is the service provider, and so on. And What we did we started coming up with potential solutions. How about if we did this? Would you be comfortable with that? Yeah. Potential solutions, meaning not offers and counter offers. Yeah. So I give you this. What do you give me in exchange? Yeah. Instead, we started thinking about, hey, how can we both structure this agreement so that it makes sense for you and it makes sense for me? Yeah? And at the end of the day, we were able to craft a partnership which was unique in the market, which was the first of its sort, of its kind. And if I'm not mistaken, it's still live and exists long after I've left the company. The core of transforming conflicts, and it means understanding the core of it, and together coming up with the potential solutions that can solve it for me, and it can solve it for them, for my partner as well.
That also has been a huge game changer for me. Something as a key learning from the course that we had back in the time, and I've been applying it quite a bit because I see it every day in the business world. You know, simple example is somebody sends an offer and it's for 10,000 euro and they're like, oh, we don't have 10,000 euro, we can take it for 8,000, and that's it. There's no conversations. And I think, you know, I don't know about your experience, but living in Scandinavia for 10 years, people there don't talk about these things. Like, usually it's like, how much is it? 10,000. Ah, okay. We'll get back to you. Hey, let's talk. You know,
exactly.
Maybe because it's not a position. As you said, it's you need to understand where people are coming from. As simple as that. And I love the example you gave, because it's, hey, let's see what really matters for this person. Maybe he feels that this 10,000 euro are too much. And that's the only reason, not that he doesn't want to pay it. Maybe there's something else you can create as a value, as a package, which is not monetary. So let's have a discussion. Let's try to see how we can create that value with each other. And this was something that, as I remember, was included in Getting to Yes, the book that you presented us back in 2012 when I was a student in your course. And we have a question from Ali. What do you think about Jing Camp negotiation strategies? Could you recommend it? Have your own top 10 books to learn this topic as first steps. Like, I don't know if it should be 10, you know, top 10 books to share, but what do you think about Jing Camp? And generally, yeah, what are some of the books, some of the directions that you would recommend for people to pay attention to? I also know that I recently read the book of Chris Voss, which in many ways is very different take on negotiation compared to the book Getting to Yes. So I'm actually curious also to hear some of these main directions in negotiations.
Yes, thank you so much for this question. The whole bookshelf behind me is full of, let me maybe try to show it, is full of negotiation books. Top 10 might be really hard, but definitely I would start. It depends a little bit on the level of interest. Yeah, if we're interested in easily digestible negotiation strategies that we can immediately apply out of the box, so to speak, let's say having read it and being able to test them, I would start with the series, the Getting series, Getting To, or Getting Past, Getting to Yes, Getting Past No, and so on, written by Bill Urey, Roger Fisher, and Bruce Patton, and then continued by William Urey. That's a canon of negotiation teaching. If someone would like to go a little bit deeper into the subject matter and would like to find out what is the scientific evidence or what are the recommendations which are backed by science, then there are a few books, let's say the one written by Roy Lewicki, the deeper, yeah, that go much deeper into the subject matter and do not quote anecdotal evidence, yeah? Meaning once I was there and then I did that and it worked, yeah? Or then I experienced this and it didn't work. Yeah? This is something which has, let's say, we as scientists can only smile at, right? This is called anecdotal evidence. Scientifically derived recommendations have a very strong consequence. Yeah, there is vast evidence that they work in more cases than just the case of anecdotal evidence. But anyways, so as an academic, I strongly believe in science and therefore my attention focuses very much nowadays on research and what research recommends us rather than what some self-proclaimed negotiation gurus have come up with as a quintessence of their professional career. Yeah? But anyway, I read those books as well. I've read Chris Voss's Never Split the Difference, and found it fascinating, though in many cases it contradicts scientific evidence. But nevertheless, I'm also very, how should I put it, very humble and modest about the limitations of science, especially in a field that is only 40 years old, such as negotiation science. I think there's still a lot to be discovered, and even if certain recommendations that such great authorities in hostage negotiations proclaim, in a sense that I science might still discover these things, in the sense that maybe in this particular case, practice has preceded science in discovering something that works and has not been proven, so to speak, or demonstrated all, in a scientific way. But in other cases, there's very, very clear evidence, for example, concerning the strategies of the first offer and other things that Chris Voss recommends against, I maybe should not say against, but despite a strong scientific evidence to the contrary.
Right. I think it's a great answer. And hopefully, Natalia, let us know if that answer was good enough for you, or would like us to elaborate more on this. One thing that I find interesting, and I think people who are watching and listening would also be curious to hear, is, all right, there are some great strategies, how to negotiate, how to prepare. There's some great books about it. You can read it. You can do all the homework, so to say. What do you do when the person or the party against you is having the upper hand, and whatever you're trying to prepare, you know that they have the power?
Mm-hmm. It's a very good question. It's something that we deal with, or we have dealt with in our teaching quite intensively. So, what do we do if there is an imbalance of power? Yeah? If our negotiation partner is or we believe that they are stronger, yeah? And they have all the aces, yeah? Their cards are better than ours. There are certain things that we can do, despite the fact, as I mentioned, that negotiation science is not magic. It is science, right? There are no magic methods. It's just many of them is hard work. But concerning this particular question, what we can, for example, do is first of all, figure out our BATNA. What is our best alternative? And trying to improve it before we actually get into a negotiation that is critical and important to us. Yeah? Very often it is possible to improve the balance or imbalance of power in my favor by simply improving my best alternative. Yeah? So let me give you a very very quick example from a student of mine that heads the procurement department at one of the large German car manufacturers, and he told me once, "Hey, we are huge. We have lots of suppliers, yeah, and we can pinpoint to almost the cent amount, the last cent amount, the cost of the supplier's parts, yeah? And still, in some cases, we knowingly and deliberately are paying multiple of those costs, yeah? And he told me other reasons than just the value or price that make such a great supplier as that German car manufacturer undoubtedly is, pay higher prices. Yeah? And one of them is the number of alternatives that they have. Yeah? If a small supplier is so specialized in their niche that it's very hard to replace him or replace them, even large car manufacturer is forced to pay whatever that supplier requires. Yeah? And second thing so that's working on my alternatives and improving my BATNA. The second thing that I always recommend in such cases is work on the relationship. Yeah? Is this how valuable is the fact that you are their supplier? Or you've been their supplier, or you can be their supplier in the next whatever x number of years. Yeah? Is this something that is possible to factor into the let's say imbalance of power component? Yeah? How easily replaceable are we, and what are the switching costs? Is there any possibility that we can factor in the value of the relationship into the whole equation? And if yes, that changes it a little bit. Yeah? Because despite of regardless of the size, regardless of my BATNAs, what also is important is their BATNA. Yeah? In other words, if the large car manufacturer has only one option, and that is us, yeah, maybe I see myself as a small supplier. Yeah? Maybe I see the number of my alternatives as low, but theirs might be even lower than I think. Yeah? So that's the second thing. That I encourage my students and the executives to think about. And then the third thing: look beyond price. Yeah? That's the third recommendation. If we believe that there is an imbalance of power, if we feel weaker, think about whether there is a possibility to expand the package with additional dimensions, with additional value generating options, yeah, that I can offer and maybe nobody else can. Yeah, that somehow strengthen my uniqueness, strengthen the uniqueness of the relationship also for my negotiation partner, but only with me, yeah, not with others. Yeah? And that these three recommendations, I think that's probably a good start to tackle the aspect of imbalance of power. Yeah? Even if we feel weak, let's not worry about it. It's the perception is a reality. Let's change and work on our perception of the situation and try to influence the perception of the situation of our negotiation power. And that's the best remedy for restoring the balance and focusing less on or moving away from someone who accepts or someone who is being imposed certain things to someone who is a value co-creator.
I think these are wonderful recommendations, and it reminded me a little bit when you spoke about the mindset when you get into the room to, have you read the book of Oren Klaff, Pitch Anything?
No, not yet.
Okay, so basically it's a very aggressive kind of a male energy kind of book where what he's saying is you need to be the price. You know, when you're pitching anything to anybody, and I think you're working a lot with startups, I'm working a lot with startups myself. There's this perception that when a startup goes to pitch to an investor, somehow they kind of put them higher up, right? Like, I'm the startup, they're the investor, I need to chase them and figure out a way for them to like me. And many founders, many entrepreneurs, and many other people, I think, get into the room with this perception, I'm here and the investor or whatever they're trying to pitch is here. And that creates the imbalance by itself because you're already with this mindset, right? So what Oren is saying is, look, you got to get into the room and you got to set the frame as such that, hey, my time is valuable, your time is valuable, I have a lot of options, I'm busy. Let's see what we have to offer you. We like what you guys have. Let us share that with you. Let us hear why you should be our investors or why you should be our clients, because we're busy. I don't want to work with anybody. I want to work with the best. Are you guys having what it takes? So he kind of shifts the perspective. Hey, this is what we have. Why should we be working with you? We're super busy. And then this shifts a little bit the balance. So, hey, we are all the same page. We want to help each other to create value. So I found this really fascinating approach to kind of shift your mindset to begin with, right?
I definitely subscribe to confidence as one of the success factors, not only for startups but also in negotiation. Something that is insecurity emanates immediately in the room. It's something that it's very easy to sense and feel in the body language, how people react and so on, right? So and being insecure, being uncertain about our own product, about our own offer, about our own startup and its value, it's if we are insecure and uncertain, how can we expect about our own product, how can we expect someone else, yeah, who's not a part of it yet, yeah, be confident about it. Yeah? So it starts from me. If I don't believe in it, yeah, nobody else will. Yeah? It's only my confidence, my faith in what I represent, and that is not only limited to negotiation situation, though the context, the startup context, that the financing context is a very strong negotiation situation, right? The amount of confidence on the startup side is can very easily be sensed by an experienced VC. Very easily, that is something that you immediately see and feel. Yeah? And that's one of the most common mistakes. Yeah? Let's say being insecure, walking in as a small little startup from the middle of nowhere, and not having the confidence in your own future, not believing in your own product. That's where it starts. This is a prerequisite of everything else.
And I have a feeling sometimes freelancers, you know, startup entrepreneurs sometimes focus a little bit too much on the service or the product. And what I mean is, let's say you're the freelance designer, or you have a startup and you have a product, and you know, I care about how good the design is, but I also, if I hire a designer to work on a project, I want to know, is this person having what it takes when it comes to their professionalism, their ethics? The same thing when you're pitching to an investor. Investor is like, okay, that's a great product. There's a great market. Is this team going to convince people to go into, you know, is this team having the confidence to pull it off? It's absolutely. Not only, you know, people focus a little bit too much on the product and the service sometimes, I feel.
Team belongs to the evaluation criteria of the VCs or accelerator operators, right? Product, market, that's where it starts. Even the greatest team cannot make, let me not use vulgarity, but something valuable out of nothing, right? But even if the market, product market fit is there, there are growth opportunities and so on, and incapable or let's say insecure, uncertain team probably won't be able to make out of it as much as a confident, experienced team would. So therefore, I completely subscribe to, also and support in my innovation or startup activities the fact that the team matters. Team matters is one of the decision criteria on whether to invest or not invest, whether to engage with one startup or another, almost just as important as the other two that we mentioned.
And I want to talk about startups and entrepreneurship, but we have another question before that to wrap up the section. And this is coming again from Ahiat from LinkedIn, and he's asking, you mentioned previously preparation would give us example on how and what to prepare for. Would you give us example on how and what to prepare for? Thank you for that.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for this question. In general, we typically start with what. What is that we are to negotiate? Yeah? This question is maybe sounds trivial, but it isn't. Yeah? Very often, also in a startup context and financing agreements, we believe that typically there is a valuation and shares, that those are the typical issues that we need to negotiate. But there might be also during the negotiation, we might discover also that there are other aspects that we had not anticipated that can be included in the deal that need to be negotiated, where we have differing views on. Yeah? So first of all, what? Yeah, that's where we start from. Yeah? Second is why. What is important to us? In other words, what are my interests? What do I want to achieve? Okay, given that this is what I want to negotiate, what is the relative importance of these things? Okay? Why is this analysis? Because this is a strictly analytical question. Why is this analysis important? Only if we figure out the relative importance of those issues to ourselves and also potentially to our partners, only then we would be ready for a discussion on engineering value. Okay? And which means where do I need to insist, or what do I need to insist on? Where can I concede, by how much, and so on. This is a consequence of a thorough analytical exercise on the preference sorting, yeah? Analysis of my preferences, right? If once I've done this for myself, I do exactly the same thing from my partner's perspective. I try to put myself in their shoes and think, hey, if I were them, what would be important to me, yeah? And why? Right. So out of this, we get a very simplified two sets of negotiation interests, yeah? Mine and theirs, plus a goal and objective, that we want to achieve. Out of this exercise, we derived also what I know and what I need to find out. Yeah? In other words, what is about this situation that I already know? What do I need to find out in order to sort of at least expand my view? Yeah? Such as I don't know, averages from the market, typical values that our investors potentially use in their analysis, and so on and so on. Yeah, what questions do I need to ask to get those answers? Yeah, potentially, right? So the information audit, yeah, the information audit. And then last thing is, how do I structure the process? Yeah? What do I need to start with in terms of my negotiation process? And also prepare a first offer and a pattern of concessions. Yeah? First offers arguably probably are the most important turning points in negotiations. We could spend hours talking about research that has gone into our ability to make that claim or support that claim. But apart from that, this is something I need to prepare. Where do I want to start? What is my initial pitch? with respect to the dimensions I consider important? And if we face a disagreement, how do we move? Where do we concede first? What do we insist on second? Yeah. So that's just a brief wrap up. I share with my students a more thorough, or with my clients, a more thorough preparation sheet that somehow organizes this process and helps us go through this process as we prepare for negotiation, and includes a couple more boxes that need to be filled. But these are the most important ones.
This is gold. And just to summarize what, for me, I think is really important, the first thing is getting things out of your head and putting it on paper. Because if they're in your head, everything is kind of complex and can mess up with the others. But when you have it in front of you and you do this analysis to define, okay, what's the best alternative for negotiated agreement? What could be for the other side? What are some other things that could create value for me, could create value for this person? And then the questions is something that's really, really powerful. What kind of questions could I potentially ask so I can extract the information that I need or lead them into a direction that I want them to go? This is powerful.
This is a great summary. This is a great summary. Then that's basically the purpose of the preparation process. And this is exactly this is how my preparation sheets are structured guide exactly along the lines that you, Stoyan, now mentioned. Yeah.
Do you go with like I don't know, just curious. Like, do you go with your notebooks to like when you have to negotiate something? So you have your notes there. Do you keep it in your phone? Like, where's your notes?
Making notes is one of the most critical parts of the ongoing negotiation process at the table. Whoever protocols, whoever writes agreements is in the lead of the negotiation process. If you write something and share with others, this is an effort, right? This is an additional effort which we don't need to exert. But I always strongly recommend to be the one doing this, because once something is written, somebody has to invest an additional effort to change it. In other words, whoever writes drives the process. So yes, definitely taking notes, highly recommendable, making contract drafts, highly recommendable, because that gives us an opportunity to include our view, our perception of what's been discussed and what's been agreed and what is still open in the draft. And that's already valuable. That's already very valuable because changing it requires additional energy that our negotiation partner would have to exert in order to get it to have it differently than what we proposed and suggest. Yeah, so definitely I do that. Yeah, I definitely do that, and I also myself, and I also strongly recommend it to all my students and clients. Yes.
From your observation, how important is who's hosting the meeting, the environment of the negotiations?
Very important. There's also research done on the venues. Where should negotiation take place? Your place, my place. What impact does it have on creating the relationship or changing the process? In general. On our home turf, we feel more confident. Okay? And yet again, visiting someone puts us in the perspective of a guest. Okay? And guests have, most of the cultures have certain rights, unless you're negotiating with big supermarket chains where they will put you in a small cubicle, start a stop clock. Hey, you have 15 minutes or I don't know, 5 minutes. It's your time. When the bell rings, it's over. Yeah? In most of the contexts, being a guest has certain privileges. So it depends a little bit what phase we are in. Are we in the relationship building phase? Are we right now in the value engineering phase, and so on. There's also a very interesting piece of research on negotiating over meals. The French way, so to speak, right, to operate with some stereotypes. There is a strong evidence that negotiating over meals improves the rapport between the parties, the relationship between the parties, and helps create value. And why? Because we are relaxed. We're sharing a meal. We're sharing a time. We're moving away from the confrontational perspective into something which is more, how should I put it, which is more friendly. While sharing a meal, while sharing our time, we find it easier also to share information. Yeah? And information sharing is something that is critical for value. And these are four generic possibility: home turf, your place, or something neutral. Maybe we combined with a meal. The answer is it depends on the phase, depends on which dimension is important in which phase, and what we want to achieve. But yes, nowadays it's there's a different sort of different issue that we're facing. Yeah? It's not your place or mine. Is who sets up the Zoom channel, right? in the COVID-19 times, it's COVID has probably sustainably changed the way people negotiate, yeah? And a lot more of the negotiations vast majority of the negotiations take place online, yeah? And there are also several recommendations also based on scientific experiments and results that govern also negotiations in online or virtual, as we sometimes call them, contexts. Yeah. But anyway, I think I'm sort of getting ahead of line. But yes, it matters. The venue matters. It's somehow context specific, and the selection depends on the results we want to achieve.
I don't think you're going anywhere above the line. Actually, I was super curious to hear some of the recommendations. That was actually my next question when you mentioned Zoom. I myself, being super relationship-based person, as you know me, one of the first things that was quite when the hope happened and self-isolation was, I cannot be close to my clients or leads. I cannot have this, you know, spontaneous non-salesy meetings or, you know, non-negotiation meetings where we just build rapport, build relationships. So I'm actually curious to hear what could somebody do. And maybe that could be the last question before we wrap up the session, because I think many people are interested and struggling to understand, how do I, you know, recreate this experience? Obviously, if you go to Paris, you can bring your client to a fancy restaurant and you can have a good meal and you can create value. But what do you do when you are not allowed to meet and you should meet virtually and come up with a similar outcome at the end of the day?
Mm-hmm. There are several things, very interesting recommendations from scientific experiments, which I'm happy to share. Something which is called schmoozing. I kind of like this English word which is used for this process. Schmoozing is negotiation non-related talk about other things, and that precedes, we would probably call it small talk in a positive context, with a positive connotation. So first of all, make sure that you schmooze. There is research which says that those who do achieve better results. And that's how we would do it in a face-to-face context, right? We would first of all try to build the relationship, try to get to know each other. In a virtual context, we have a very strong tendency to get down to business quickly. And this is how this channel works on us if we are not controlling it, not controlling our reactions. Yeah? So first of all, make sure that you take your time, make sure that you schmooze, make sure that you make compliment, make sure that you somehow work on setting the right positive tone and attitude. Whatever it takes, invest your time in it, because this is probably the best investment you will have in terms of that particular relationship. Second, postpone deal making until later. So teams that start juggling with offers and counter offers too soon end up with worse results. In other words, first of all, after you've discussed, let's say, the personal or relational issues, try to understand, try to present the subject matter, but in a non-bargaining way. Exchange as much information as you possibly can and leave deal making. And the third thing that's also quite interesting, because online we have an option of negotiating with video or without, and there's strong scientific evidence which supports having the video on. Those negotiators who have their videos on tend to be more cooperative. Apparently, mirroring ourselves in a video leads to the fact that we like seeing ourselves as cooperative. And the ability to see ourselves on the screen induces the cooperative approach. So if there is a choice, always go with video.
So I can imagine you've been growing your beard for the last couple of weeks for this podcast, so we can be more cooperative and I can potentially ask you more pleasant questions. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Stoyan, I was trying to imitate you, but your beard is definitely better than mine. That's schmoozing.
Hey, look, you mirrored me well. By the way, great beard. That's something to to keep in consideration. Remy, it's been such a pleasure. I definitely want to have you back at the podcast at some point, because for me it felt like playing one of these video games when you kind of cut the head of the monster and there are two new, heads of questions and more and more and more. So I have maybe 20 more questions to ask, but I think it's a pretty good time for us to wrap up this section and let people go and maybe apply some of those techniques of your negotiation tomorrow or later this week. I would like to invite you now to maybe share with us a great initiative that, guys, I'm 100%, 150% behind this initiative that Remy is organizing. Why don't you, Remy, share with us a little bit more about the negotiation challenge? And now it's open for professionals, which is a big news. So what is the negotiation challenge? And what is it this year being open for professionals?
Thank you, Stan, for giving me this opportunity. With pleasure. For many years, we've organized negotiation competitions, and this year, for the first time, it's open to those negotiating professionally. Basically, the Negotiation Challenge is an international negotiation competition open to business professionals, to lawyers, to diplomats, politicians, regardless of what you do, regardless of your hierarchy level. If you negotiate with passion, join us. I see Stoyan prepared also the link. It's professionals.thenegotiationchallenge.org. Go on the website, visit our website, look for the details that you need to find. And we've already received first registrations. Teams from all possible continents. We have teams from, we have negotiators from Japan, USA, Europe, Africa. We're hoping for more. Registration deadline is August 30th, so we have 12 more days. If you're interested, please feel free to and have questions, please feel free to reach out to us. What we can promise is that we've prepared exciting and challenging negotiation simulations for you already, and you will be matched in the competition. You will be matched with other passionate negotiators located somewhere else, probably. And your task will be to come up with an agreement based on the simulation that that we've prepared for you. An exciting event, that creates a lot of momentum and energy for the participants. An event which is based on academic standards in terms of judging criteria, evaluation criteria. That's something that is very important to us. They are very transparent. And our vision is to build the first world championship in negotiation. And this we are working very strongly on this. And we hope someday this this initiative that we started, the negotiation challenge, will become a prototype of the world championship.
So let me try to see if I understand correctly. It is all virtual, and the other thing I think that is important for people to know, who can join this challenge? So anybody, doesn't matter how much they know about it academically, how much they use it to work, everybody listening right now can go to this webpage, check out the rules and sign up and be part of it.
Exactly. We strongly recommend that you have some background in negotiation, because you'd be exposed to really heavy hitters. And having seen the registrations, I can tell you this: these are people who are who've been active in the field sometimes for more than 20 years. Yeah? So, but I wouldn't discourage anyone who is ambitious, David, to stand against the Goliath. Yeah. So if you have the passion, if you believe that you're a good negotiator and you have what it takes, go to the website, register for the competition. It's open to just anyone, just like a world championship needs to be, right? It's open to everyone, and you guys will be exposed to really cool negotiation experience.
Guys, Dr. Remi Smolinski, Professor Remi Smolinski, what a pleasure having you after close to 10 years after you were a teacher at this summer school in Aarhus University. Super, super excited. If you guys are tuning in right now, go back to the podcast and listen to the whole episode. It's full of golden nuggets. Remi, I would love to hear, you know, if you have anything to share, but to share a final message to everybody who's watching or listening right now, and as both of us know, many people are going through difficult months, difficult year. A lot of unexpected events have been happening with the pandemic, people losing their jobs, losing business, or even, you know, people having health issues and losing a close lot. What did you recommend for people who are going through uncertainty, going through struggles, and how should we leave them?
A very good question. Yes, we are all going through very difficult times, but difficult times are also times of opportunity. Yeah? It doesn't help if we sit down and start complaining how difficult it is, how hard the situation is that we are currently in. What only helps is action. Yeah? Let's use this time to be creative about ourselves, yeah? About what is the core of us, yeah? What makes us happy, yeah? What is that that we do with love and passion, and what is that we enjoy. Yeah? And let us, once we figure out what it is for us, let's be productive in pursuing it, in pursuing our passion. This is probably what changed at some point, also changed the quality of my life as well. At some point, I realized what I enjoy doing, and I started focusing on the things that I love doing. And the ability, and that's the first part of the component. That's the first component of happiness. I think the other one is being able to share it. Yeah, is being able to share it. So first of all, finding and then sharing with others, and Just like you guys, you Stoyan, are doing it with your podcast, with your upcoming project, right? Upcoming book, and this is really great stuff. And if someone feels has found passion, a natural urge is to share it with others. Yeah, and this is negotiation and innovation has been my great passion, and I absolutely love pursuing it. I love investigating it, trying to understand the deepest depth of it. And as I do so, I also enjoy sharing it with others. And I think this is a piece of advice that I can definitely share. On top of it, the world will include conflict. It's everywhere we go. It's regardless of how accommodating we are as in terms of our personalities, we will encounter conflict. The quality of our life is defined by not our ability to avoid it, but our ability to resolve and manage it. And I think negotiation, understanding the core of negotiation, helps us deal with exactly this complexity of conflict, and turn it from a destructive downward spiral into a value engineering opportunity. And so that's something that I would like to conclude also this podcast with. Being able to negotiate means being able to solve conflict and being able to improve the quality of our life.
Thank you guys for listening. And if you're looking for somebody to help you step up your team performance and boost your productivity, make sure to check out stoyanyankov.com for online workshop solutions and programs designed to help you go through the current situation in a smoother manner. Stay safe and keep moving forward.